Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us at the internet, commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jessica Vassalero, Senior Technology Reporter for the Wall Street Journal and the moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Adam Leshinsky. Adam is one of Silicon Valley's most admired, and I might add, most well-liked reporters. Senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, he's a prolific investigative reporter, having written about many of the Valley's biggest companies. There are a few big topics in tech he hasn't touched, from his stories about the behind-the-scenes drama of Mark Hurd's ouster as CEO of HP, to his frequent writing about the inner workings of Apple. Adam is a familiar face on TV and a weekly panelist on the Fox News Channel's Cavuto on Business program. He also chairs Fortune's annual technology conference, Fortune Brainstorm Tech. Prior to joining Fortune, Adam was a columnist for the San Jose Mercury News and thestreet.com. He's a native of Chicago and currently lives in San Francisco with his wife and daughter. His book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works, was published in January to rave reviews and recently debuted on the New York Times' bestseller list. Adam, we'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you. And I think it speaks to the fundamental difference, one of the many fundamental differences between myself and Steve Jobs, that it makes me feel particularly good to hear you say that I'm well-liked, because that makes me feel very good. And this is something that he didn't necessarily care about. There's only one name on the cover of a book, at least a book that's written by one person. But as someone who has sat in Jessica's chair and interviewed out-of-towners, it's a great joy for me to be doing this tonight in my hometown, and I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize a few of the people who are here who helped me in innumerable ways to write this book. My wife, Ruth Kirshner, is here. She knows very well that not only have I been gone a lot, but I have been more distracted than I would like to have been when I wasn't gone. Many of my neighbors from my neighborhood in San Francisco are here tonight, and many of my friends from my 15 years here, and I appreciate your being here. The entire Fortune magazine technology team is here. That includes those of us who are in San Francisco and New York. And three very special people at the top of that team are here. Stephanie Mehta, the executive editor of Fortune, who edited my article in Fortune magazine that grew into this book. Andy Serwer, the editor of Fortune magazine, who gave me this wonderful assignment to write an article in Fortune that grew into a book. And lastly, the editor-in-chief, and there have not been many editors-in-chief of Time Inc. John Huey is here tonight, and John's been extremely supportive of my work, and including writing this book. And before I eagerly await your questions, Jessica, I would just thank one last entity. That is the 600-pound gorilla in the room, which is I just want to thank Apple. And I want to thank Apple for being so wonderfully difficult. Apple is a difficult company to cover, and I admire Apple for its difficultness, if that's a word, because Apple is incredibly focused, which is part of the thesis of my book. They are focused on what is best for Apple. And if you think about it in a corporate sense or a fiduciary sense, a shareholder sense, that's a really good thing for a company to be focused on itself and what is best for itself. And what I came to understand is that, because, well, partly you'd have to be simple to not understand this, Apple is only interested, thank you so much, in, professionally speaking, in one thing in terms of dealing with the outside world, and that is Apple's products. The only reason that Apple wants to engage people like Jessica and me is to talk about its products. It is not interested, professionally again, in the topic of how Apple works. And again, I admire them for that, because that doesn't necessarily help them sell iPads or iPhones or Macintosh computers and so on. And they do that extremely well. They sell well, they manufacture well, they manage well, and they promote well. And part of that is because they promote what is of their choosing. And this is a theme that I come back to over and over. And my higher arching theme that I'll leave you with is that, and this sort of was a realization over the time of working on Apple over the past year, is that in so many ways, Apple is different from every other company in the country and in the world. And in fact, the way they do business is different from the way business is taught in business schools. And so I decided that it would be interesting to ask the question, well, if this company is the world's most valuable company, now we don't have to keep saying on this day or that day, it is the world's most valuable company. And if they do everything that they do so well, maybe the business school should be teaching something different. And I think I know that's something those are some of the topics that you want to get into. So I'll turn it over to you. Thank you.
It's hard to pick a place to start, and everyone should read the book. But, you know, one thing I really like about your book, and it's a big theme right now, is how is Apple changing? With the passing of Steve Jobs and just the competition in the industry, it's a huge theme. And you actually come out in your book stronger than I think some other places do and say it's going to change. And here are some of the ways. Can you talk about those?
Sure. I mean, you're starting at the end, and I'm very conscious, Jessica, of not giving you any material to write about in the Wall Street Journal, at least that we don't get a chance to write about.
Well, actually, to say myself, when we talked a little bit about this before, you did, as part of your answer, tell the story about how you decided to write the book and how the end sort of came together more quickly. So that would probably maybe be a better place to start and get here.
You want me to start with how I decided to do the book?
Sure. Yeah, let's start there. You convinced me. I changed my mind. We'll get to the other one.
I'll do both for you quickly.
Perfect.
I mean, the people say, why did you decide to write about this? And I have a very simple answer. My editor asked me to. And this grew out of, and this it's interesting. Some of this was actually mentioned in Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. Jobs had been in for meetings at Time Inc. and had mentioned that Apple behaves like a startup, and that Apple has no committees, for example. And Andy Serwer said to him, gee, that's interesting. We'd like to write a story about that. And Steve said, nah, yeah, we'll see sometime. And eventually Andy decided we were done waiting, and he asked me to do it. And so I just started doing it. What I came to understand is that I was asking a different question from what other journalists were asking, or other journalists had asked and had been told no. So I got told no also, obviously, but I just kept on going. And so I'll answer your question. I believe that, and I'd like to see some academic research to back this up, that Apple has just had the most amazing 15-year run of any company, perhaps in the history of companies. They've done very little wrong, not nothing, but very little wrong, and what little they've done wrong has been completely overwhelmed by all the things they've done right. And so I think if Steve Jobs were alive and well, they could not have another 15-year run like the 15-year run that they've just had. If for no other reason, because of their sheer size and the complexity of the company that they've worked so hard to avoid is upon them. And so there will be changes. We've seen subtle changes already. I think it was symbolically very important. The first public act that Tim Cook made was to declare that the company would now, for the first time in years or ever, I don't know, match U.S. employees' philanthropic donations up to $10,000. This was important because Jobs thought that was a bunch of hooey. Mm-hmm.
And he did it right away.
He did it quickly, and he showed that he was listening to employees because this was something that they cared about. And I say this in the book, Apple has a fundamental problem that, or a challenge that they will have to grapple with, which is that Steve Jobs was one of the greatest entrepreneurs we'll ever know. And the people at the top of the org chart, which we published in Fortune, who are running Apple today are not entrepreneurs and they're bones the way he was. And meaning no disrespect to him, Tim Cook bled IBM blue for the first 10 plus years of his career. That is not the making of an entrepreneur.
One thing that in the giving program is a great example. I mean, I hear, and you know, even Apple folks will whisper it like they want us to think it, that Apple is getting more transparent. This idea that Steve, you know, the whole theme of your book is really secrecy and illustrating and, you know, the extent of it from building secret conference rooms to house products. And but do you see signs that part of this new era is going to be more transparency?
No way. You know. No. They're being more transparent on one topic in particular, and that's this labor issue in China. And they would say that they've been transparent on that, in their opinion, for a handful of years now, since they first issued that supplier report. And then they trumpeted the fact that they named their suppliers this year, so it was more transparent than the previous year. It's interesting that this is a unique and interesting issue, because they were the subject of a lot of criticism on their, not just on their labor practices of their partner Foxconn, but also their environmental record. And so you can see where the rare instances are that Apple cares about criticism. It cared about criticism on those two issues. But I can't imagine that they're going to become more transparent on the normal corporate stuff that they've been so good at being at having a lack of transparency on. I can't imagine why they would.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think will happen if you have a company that's been led by a visionary entrepreneurial type? You said Tim bleeds IBM blue. So
bled. I mean, let's be fair to him. He loves Apple. We've heard him say that over and over. But his training, his formative years were at IBM.
There's a great amount of very senior leadership, but all with very different skills. I mean, what does this company look like in 5 years?
Well, this is an example of how the company inevitably will change, I think. And I've described this as what I believe is a religious debate at the highest levels of Apple and among the senior people who have left Apple. You get people with very strong opinions on both sides of this. Apple's going to run off the rails. It's never going to be as great as it was, is one argument. The other argument is this is a company with so much excellence and so much greatness and so much process that it will continue to be great. And I conclude, I lean in the latter direction. I lean, you know, I'm not willing to make any absolute statements. I think that would be foolish. Number one, there is a ton of excellence in the company. They've hired really good people who buy into the mission of the company, which is an important part of the Apple story. And, you know, number two, there's all sorts of functions of the company that have that Steve Jobs didn't have his fingers on for several years now. And these are the parts of the company that Tim Cook has effectively been in charge of for, you know, you name the number of years, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, 10 years in some cases. And so the thing we don't know, the one big intangible, was that Steve Jobs made the final decision on anything that mattered. And he had this, you know, uncanny ability to do that, an almost idiot savant ability to say, this is where we're going to go, and we're not going there. And I have no idea, and we have no idea how they're going to replicate, replace, or pivot from that.
One thing, theme that always surprises me about the company, or it is really strong in your book, is, you know, despite this being the world's most valuable company right now, the people who are there don't think a ton about money, right? I mean, this isn't a company, or you talk a lot about the culture of, you know, that people don't talk about getting rich and that's not why they're in it.
Yeah.
At the same time, this is a company who's known for, you know, pinching its suppliers on fractions of a penny for every component down its supply chain. And they clearly have some pretty money-minded folks there. Do you think Apple can maintain that sort of the image of sort of the culture and the brand? And how do they reconcile that with not only is the company obviously very operationally minded, but now there's someone of that mold running it too.
So, it calls to mind the joke about, why are rich people so cheap? Well, how do you think they got rich in the first place? And there is an element of that in Apple. So there's sort of two separate subjects. There's the personal mentality about money at the company, and then there's the company's relationship with wealth and spending money. And like many things with Apple, there's a lot of paradoxes at play here. So Jobs had an odd relationship with money. He lived a relatively humble life for a multi-billionaire. And he was openly critical of people who would talk about money, and in particular who would talk about making money as being the goal of business, because he never stressed that business was about making money. For him, it was about creating great products, and, we're going to do that extremely well, and, of course we're going to make money. And then another paradox at Apple is that, on the one hand, Apple people will describe the company as being resource constrained. I had the hardest time understanding what in the world they were talking about. And I came to understand they really were referring to the difficulty of finding enough people to do the projects that they wanted to do. They could never staff up as much as they wanted to. Having said that, so they'll, on the one hand, pinch a supplier. On the other hand, when they want to spend money, whether it's on, forward purchases of DRAM or buying the equipment that is necessary for outstanding manufacturing processes, or, as I describe in the book, incredibly lavish spending to market a product exactly the way they want to, they'll spend almost anything. So this is something where I'm actually very optimistic for Apple. I think these are cultural attributes of this company, and I think these cultural attributes die hard. So whereas on the one hand, it's going to be hard to find somebody with this ability to say, no, we're not going to do the iPad now, we're going to do the iPhone first. Incredible decision. That I don't know, but I think this culture of focusing on product over revenue optimization will persist. And by the way, you talk to people who went to Apple in the late 90s or early 2000s, in the first few years of Steve's return, long before it was evident that the company was going to be a major financial success again, none of them went there for the money. Their friends told them they were crazy to be joining this loser company. And above a certain level, they all got stinking rich in the process.
Happens a lot out here. But anyway. So there are a couple great things for the questions. Everyone keeps sending them. A couple questions around whether Steve Jobs was a good manager or not, and whether, I guess speaking more to what people can learn and what you've learned through your sort of case study, what should people take away and try? What should they leave?
So leaving aside the social aspect for a moment, he was an astoundingly good manager in that he focused on what he thought was important, and he did a very good job of forcing his people to focus on what was important. And I think one of the most telling elements of his management style was, it gets a bit tiresome, but in conversations about Apple, the word product comes up over and over and over. It gets, because they repeat it, and they will say, this is one of the things they will say, it's all about product. But they mean it, and the evidence of this is the product review process that Jobs had. And so basically every important project was reviewed every Monday unless the executive team couldn't get to it, and then they reviewed it the following Monday. Many companies have this quarterly product review concept, but Jobs felt as a manager that there was nothing more important than managing than paying attention to the product. And so he would review it obsessively. And I describe in the book how middle-level people spend their careers at Apple preparing their bosses, who are preparing their bosses, who are preparing their bosses for a presentation to Steve Jobs and the executive team, and now Tim Cook and the executive team. So I think he managed that extremely well.
What about the Steve bottleneck you refer to in the book?
So the Steve Jobs bottleneck that I refer to is that, for good or ill, Steve Jobs only concentrated on a small handful of things at once. And he made very shrewd decisions over the last 15 years about what to concentrate on. The upside of his concentration was the iPhone, for example. The downside was, and this is something that Apple people talk about, if you work in a part of the company that he wasn't concentrating on, you got no attention. Nothing moved forward on your project. It was very obvious to you that you were not in the cool crowd. And Apple would not move forward on that. And so this would frustrate managers of all sorts. And I know people who left the company who would say, well, I had my time. I worked on the hot product. The heat shifted. I didn't. It was time for me to leave because I knew I wasn't going to get any attention anymore. So I suggest in the book, and I haven't decided if this is a good thing or not, but I think that you, to get back to your initial question, that the modern Apple will probably be, that management will cure some of those bottlenecks, and they'll pay more attention to more things. You could see that being a good thing for running a $400 billion market cap company, but you could see it being an abandonment of what made them great, too.
Couple questions also about what was the most difficult aspect or bit of reporting for the book to verify? Maybe you can also broaden that out to the biggest challenges. You probably knew it was going to be hard going in, but what was harder than you thought?
Well, being able to do enough reporting to learn to think about a senior Apple executives as human beings was probably one of the more difficult aspects of writing a book, you know, about a company, because the company does such an effective job of keeping these human beings out of the public eye and away from people like you and me, that there's something, there's something godlike about them. Again, only because, as human beings, if you can't touch something and you can't interact with it, you have a hard time relating to it at a personal level. So, you know, Apple for the last 15 years only allowed one human being to have a personality. And, you know, I feel like with a lot of reporting, I was able to overcome that. But, you know, I remember at the last Apple event, the day before Steve Jobs died, the last Apple event I attended, right after it was over, I went up and shook hands with Scott Forstall. I'd never met Scott Forstall before. And, you know, I think he and I are almost the same age. I think he's maybe a year or two younger than I am. And, I think his kids are a little older than my daughter. And yet, I was a little nervous. Like, I'm meeting this person I've never spoken to before and who is very important in my life right now.
It happens. Cheers. Some of the audience members were here when Walter Isaacson came to discuss his book. And I was wondering how you would compare the two. And obviously Walter's book, he had access to Steve and was many ways authorized, although, you know, he did his own thing. But how would you compare them?
So Walter Isaacson's magnificent book was a view, first of all, a biography of a man and a view from the top. His sourcing was Steve Jobs and Bono and Tim Cook and Johnny Ive and people like that. And he got amazing material that even the people closest to Steve Jobs over many years had never seen before. And that was among the great pieces of value in Walter Isaacson's book. But it was very much, first of all, a biography of a person and a view from the top. My book is a book about a company and how it works, which wasn't necessarily Walter's task. And my perspective is up and down and around the organization. And while I talk to and quote by name many senior people in the book, I also talk to a ton of mid-level and junior people, because my perspective is that their perspective is very important for the story that I was trying to tell. Whereas Walter was trying to tell a story about a man's life, and so that man was very important to that story.
Do you think his view or your view of Apple, the company, is more or less flattering, or do you think your view is less flattering than his?
Is less flattering? Well, I think to the extent that there's been a lot of controversy about all of the personal aspects of Steve Jobs' life that Walter Isaacson put in the book, and I think he didn't do a ton of analysis about the company. And I think I do, because it was my subject, I think I did more analysis of the company. And, you know, I am an admirer of Apple and Apple's accomplishments, but I don't think, If you ask me to list the attributes that describe my approach to writing a book about Apple, I don't think admirer would be first. I think, you know, analyst and describer would come before that.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Adam Leshinsky, senior editor-at-large with Fortune magazine and author of the latest bestseller, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Who should read this book?
Everybody. Yeah. I would humbly suggest that there's three types of people who should run out and
conveniently
buy this book.
Package for us.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, don't care about the format. Hardcover, electronic. I recorded the audiobook. That's fine with me too. That was great fun to read for 14 hours approximately. And Ode, you get some insight into your sentence structure when you read your own work. So I think that executives at big companies are going to want to read this book to try to understand how Apple operates, because every big company faces this absolute crisis of how to innovate at scale, how to be nimble when you're big. And I can't think of a company that has been nimbler at size as Apple has been. I think that entrepreneurs who are in startups are going to want to read this book, because there are a lot of practical tips about how to be entrepreneurial in this book. And one, it's not exclusive to entrepreneurs, but Jobs was very articulate and very good about focus. And he would talk about the power of saying no. It's more important to say no than to say yes. You should figure out what it is that you're good at and do that. It sounds so simple, but most companies are horrible at that. And startups at least have the opportunity, because they're young and they haven't made all the mistakes yet, to at least make the one very important mistake of what they're good at least screw up or succeed at what you're good at. And then lastly, I think that this book was fascinating for me in thinking about my own career, and I think that other people will find it as sort of a career tonic or something like that, because I was blown away doing my research at how focused Apple people are. They do not multitask. I multitask. And, you know, they come into work and they work for their 14 or 16 hour days at whatever their task is. And that struck me as being very unusual. And it was easy to see what the virtues of that, at least for a period of time, are. I was able to capture some of that when I had a brief leave to work on the book. And then I went right back to it. You know?
There are a couple questions about reaction to the book from the company. Anything to say there?
Extremely little, which is really how we like it.
Yep.
Because we all know the alternative. And, I really don't have anything more to say about official reaction. I've had some very nice back-channel, unofficial comments from human beings who work at Apple, and they are all human beings who have told me some very nice things about my portrayal of the company.
Which companies do you think are Apple's biggest threat right now? The
most obvious threat is Google, in that Google is culturally the antithesis of Apple in nearly every way. And then Google is coming after Apple in some very specific areas, a mobile advertising or mobile device platform being the most obvious example. And the fact that they're coming at it from such a different perspective of, you know, giving away operating software for mobile platforms as opposed to for many device manufacturers, as opposed to Apple's closed garden, walled garden approach of packaging its software with its hardware and running its own application and ecosystem, is the most glaring example of a head-on fight. But and they're fighting for a lot of other things like talent and, I don't know, mind share. But so that's the most obvious one. But it's only the most obvious one. Samsung is a threat, and you can go down each of Apple's major product lines, and you know, you could say that a lot of startups are a threat as well. you didn't ask this, but you know, Apple has never done anything particularly good in social media. So in a sense, Facebook and Twitter are threats. They're benign threats right now from a revenue perspective, but
and another question about how is Apple going to retain its top talent? So it likes to talk about having a pretty deep bench, but what does it have to do to keep them?
Well, it's not just Apple's top talent that it needs to be concerned about, but all of its talent. And there was a period when I was reporting for the magazine article where I was asking former Apple employees if working at Apple was fun. And the common response would be something like, people have a sense of mission at Apple. And I would say, yes, but is it fun? And they would say, people at Apple take great pride in their accomplishments. It's really fun to look around the room and see people using Apple products. And I say, okay, I get it. I'll stop asking if it's fun. And I think for the time being, there is a tremendous amount of momentum and enthusiasm for being on the winning team. And people do buy into the mission at Apple. It is a truly unique environment. It's only for certain people. And if you're one of those people, you're going to have a great experience. But you know, I don't want to sugarcoat it. They are losing a lot of talent. They haven't lost any senior talent, with the exception of Ron Johnson, the former head of retail.
They gave some pretty big stock bonuses too, right, recently.
And they've paid up at the senior level, and they pay up in a specialist level too. When they want a specialist, they get them. So they haven't been tested yet. So I discussed this topic with a very important an executive of a very important financial company who was asking me about this, and I was explaining Apple's mentality, and this executive said, well, you know, in the finance industry, we have our very obvious ups and downs, and we have to pay attention to employee happiness, employee satisfaction. They'll be tested when they go through a down period. It's been a long time since Apple's had one of those.
Yeah, the stock is not going down. But,
nope. That helps. Make no mistake, right?
So Apple has about $100 billion in cash right now, which is extraordinary. And it's creating – I mean, the company has to figure out something to do with it, shareholders argue, and they probably agree. What do you think will happen?
So first of all, I mean, very quick history. The reason Apple has all this cash is that Steve Jobs was freaked out about running out of cash, because he remembers in 1997 when the company didn't have much of it. He said they were 90 days from solvency. It's insolvency. It's a line he repeated frequently in his later years. And so he was almost like a Depression era baby about this issue of cash and debt. There's actually very little evidence, Jessica, that they do care what investors think about their use of the cash.
I mean, Tim Cook spoke at an investor conference yesterday. It was a big change.
He appeared many times before, or several times before, at that Goldman Sachs conference. He seems to like the Goldman Sachs investor conference venue for trying his lines out. You know, it's like they call it the act out off Broadway in the summer stock or something like that. That's where he goes, but. And he has made a few comments to the effect of, well, we're thinking about this cash issue. I'm sure they're thinking about it, because it's brain dead obvious that having $98 billion worth of cash is not the best use of that cash from a financial perspective. But I'm just not convinced that this is even remotely high on Apple's list of priorities. I do think they'll start paying a dividend, because that will be the best thing that they can come up with. I don't think they're going to do a multi-billion dollar acquisition. It would be so culturally traumatic for them to do. I could be wrong. And I can't think of I can't think of what else to do.
Look in your product crystal ball a little bit into the future. A lot of speculation around television and developing something on that front. I mean, Apple has its sort of model is to try to come out with an innovator in a new category. The iPhone wasn't like other phones. Mm-hmm. iPad wasn't like anything else. I mean, what's going to be the next thing that we all want to go buy?
So here's how and why I'm going to dodge that question. Because
it's like interviewing someone at Apple.
Yeah. Well, not exactly, because they would just say no. But I'll give you, I mean, in all candor, I mean, my edge is not product gossip. I'm not good at it with regard to Apple. There's all these blogs that are, you know, obsessively trading in rumors about what Apple's next product is going to be. most of which over time are wrong, some of which over time are right. And so I don't have an edge there. My edge has been trying to analyze and explain this company as a business. What I do think, but I'll give you two thoughts, two sort of, I hope they'll be value-added thoughts, which is not an Apple-like thing to do in an interview. One is that they've been so good at coming up with new, entering new industries, as you've said. And so we know that's the, we know they're thinking about that. You know, they, Jobs told Isaacson, I think I've got this TV thing figured out. We really don't know what that means, although we all think we know what it means. We don't. But, so they have an idea about how they're going to create a new category in television. So that's exciting. And they're completely willing to cannibalize their existing products. I mean, the iPod is a declining growth product right now, and they don't care, which is tremendous. And I just offer sort of a wonky observation, which is that they're very nimble about some straight up the middle business things, which may be a reflection of Tim Cook's leadership, maybe not. If you look at this phenomenal quarter they just had, this $13 billion profit and 37 million iPhones sold in one quarter, that was a result of, for the first time in their history, going to a free price point on an iPhone. And we all know they make tremendous profit on this free iPhone because the carrier pays for that and subsidizes it to the customer. But they had always been about a high price point. And I think that shows some business flexibility on their part.
That's something that would be really interesting to watch, because particularly in the with the iPod, they sort of diversified a little bit, went down to some cheaper products. Haven't done that with the iPhone, but bringing the cost down. And you know, today the Mac, what do you see as the future for the Mac? Because it's fairly premium still, but cost will probably go down too.
You know, what is so interesting about the Mac, so when you study Apple, what you begin to appreciate is what a risky enterprise it is. They have so relatively few product areas for their size that they've engaged in these bet the company efforts multiple times over the last handful of years. And they've been very good about their small bets too. So they made a small bet on Apple TV, didn't work, big deal. Made a small bet on mobile me. This email system didn't work, no big deal. They made a big bet on the iPhone, a big bet on the iPad, this huge bet on DRAM memory, knowing what was coming down the pike with the iPod and the iPhone, and it worked. So these big bets have worked huge. The Macintosh business gives them this incredible cushion to take risks, because it is now, and this would have been shocking to have said 10 years ago, but it is now their cash cow business, and they are milking it. There's not a ton of innovation in the Macintosh. The MacBook Air, the beautiful laptop, was the last big innovation. You could say the App Store on the Mac was an innovation. Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that. And so, but they have this franchise that is growing at faster than the rate of the rest of the industry that just does nothing but throw off cash that they can invest in other things.
Going back to actually the Google question, a lot of questions in here about Google. Maybe there's some Googlers in the audience. But there's major patent wars going on right now between Apple's basically suing companies that make Android phones, not Google directly, going after Samsung in particular, but just down the line. Again, more from a legal point of view, I mean, is this just something reporters like to write a lot about, or how are these really intense patent wars going to affect consumers and affect the industry?
Well, I'd never be the one to say the subject is just something that journalists like to write about, because this is a very important topic. And, we pretty much saw Google buy Motorola perhaps solely for its patent portfolio. And I have not reported deeply on this. I don't believe it's going to hurt consumers, because there's going to be enough competition still when the patent war ends. I do think there will be a truce. They'll get through their litigation. They'll do the cross-licensing that's necessary. That's how these things typically play out. And then they'll be done. And then they'll move on. And then there'll be another cycle sometime in the future. But I think it's a very important story.
If you're RIM, the BlackBerry maker, what do you do to compete?
They've got a tough road ahead of them. all I can do, I don't have any great insight on what RIM should do, so I'll just channel Steve Jobs and what he told, for example, Yahoo when they were floundering and trying to decide what they should do. And he told them, in an anecdote that I recount in the book, yeah, figure out what you're really good at and do that, and don't do the other things. And RIM needs a strategy that plays on what it's really good at. We know what they're really good at, which is email. And their problem more recently is that hasn't been good enough.
RIM, sort of as a case study, reminds me of something we hear a lot in the industry, which is, Apple's had this enormous success, but it's really nuked a lot of other companies with its success in that, a lot of businesses have changed. So one example that I think we're seeing right now is the wireless industry, where carriers are really struggling, but sort of rushing to offer the iPhone. There's a theory out there that Apple's sort of, benefiting, and they're the worse off for it. But both maybe the wireless case, but also more broadly, is Apple a bully? Is it an enemy? Is it is that a fair sort of characterization of it?
Yes. And then I'll expand in sort of two ways. The first way is so what, and that's that would be something that Jobs would have said. So what? He literally said that. But it's a very fair topic. I mean, let's take Apple's behavior out of it for a second. I don't have any sympathy for the industries that Apple has disrupted. One of the genius things that Apple has done over the last 10 years is gone into industries that either were sick and didn't know it, or were about to become sick, and they out-innovated in those markets. So we know the music example, and we know that Apple figured out that the carrier relationship wasn't necessarily the best one for users, and it certainly wasn't the best one for device manufacturers, and Apple went and changed the nature of the relationship with the carriers to its benefit. And we could debate whether or not it was for the consumer's benefit. I think people who love their iPhones would say that it was for their benefits. I mean, no one has a love affair with their wireless company, but people do have a love affair with their device, both with the hardware and with the user interface, the way the device behaves. Where I think there's a lot of room for analysis is in Apple, what you called Apple's bullying. No one has, at least now in 2012, if there ever were, now there's no illusions about dealing with Apple. You understand, I quote somebody in the book saying that there's no such thing as a true partnership with Apple. Partnerships are one way with Apple's way. And undoubtedly, if an Apple executive were sitting here, they would disagree with that, and they would give you chapter and verse about how our partners benefit from the relationship with us. And in fact, there's no disputing that the partner benefits the relationship with Apple. Nobody put a gun to Sprint's head to come late to the game and be an iPhone to carry the iPhone. So, I think the one-way street of Apple's relationship with the people that it deals with, in a way, creates an opportunity for competitors to have a more cordial relationship with their partners and with their suppliers. And if there's one thing, again, I'll pat Apple on the back. They are absolutely paranoid about their position in any market that they're in. It is not a culture that sits back in the chair and says, we're really good. No one's gonna take us on. It's a culture that is forward and gunning for the next thing.
In your research, did you find other companies that were similar, either from in sort of that approach?
Incredibly few. And so, it's been, I get this question. It's been suggested to me that Amazon has a lot of characteristics like Apple. And the one that I'll vouch for is that, and this is sometimes overlooked in all of the fawning over Apple's excellence, that Apple's an incredibly long-term thinking company. And this has to do with, call it arrogance, call it narcissism of Steve Jobs, but he truly behaved like a long-term investor, right down to the point of not caring what investors thought about his decisions, which I think more public companies in particular should be arrogant about their investors. I know that's absolutely heretical on Wall Street, but good managers should do what they think is best for the company, not what their investors think is best for the company, and they should be willing to get fired if they're wrong. And so Amazon, I took a digression, is a long-term thinking company, and clearly there's a lot of product excellence. But, you know, the list is not a long one. You know, another good example of it I talk about in the book is that there's a lot of Apple DNA in Tesla. Tesla is a risk-taking company, and they openly are copying Apple in their showroom retail approach, right down to some of the use of these beautiful primary colors and hiring an ex-Apple retail executive to run their retail operation. But I think what's more alarming is how many companies there are that don't emulate Apple, that don't seem to be thinking about Apple's way of doing things, and there aren't even that many startups. And then just to play on one question you didn't ask, and I get into this in the book, it's shocking how few ex-Apple executives there are who are in major positions in Silicon Valley companies.
Why do you think that is?
So the senior team that was with Steve Jobs from the 1997 onward period were extremely loyal. He demanded and he commanded and got loyalty from them and convinced them to stay for a very long time. This was an incredibly stable team for an incredibly long period of time. And I think when they did leave, they were exhausted and wealthy. And then I don't know if I necessarily agree, but I do quote people in the book suggesting that the Apple experience doesn't prepare you for life on the outside, and that you're used to taking direction from this charismatic visionary, and you don't have a public profile, by the way. We haven't discussed this yet, but Apple people are literally, well, I shouldn't say literally, Apple people check their ego at the door when they walk in. You're not going to go speak at conferences. You're not going to be at an event like this. You're not going to give press interviews because you feel like giving a press interview. And you're not going to be reaching for the accolades of your industry, which is common among senior executives in every industry. And so one might argue that this puts Apple people at a disadvantage when they leave Apple.
What's more important to Apple's future, hardware or software? And will we see non-Apple products running Apple software?
I can't think of an example of... Oh, well, you mean like a Windows PC, for example,
running
iTunes.
So for now, Apple controls the stack. They think that's sort of the secret sauce that helps them build great products, having the hardware and software. Do you see... I guess the first part is which is more important to its future? And do you see a future where Apple says, you know, our software is so great, we're going to let it go on other people's devices?
No. With this small exception to the fact that they did, and reluctantly, by the way, put iTunes on the PC platform. And Walter Isaacson has very nice color on that, I think, on that decision-making process. But Look, I talk a lot about Apple's culture, and Apple's culture is very important to it. And Apple's culture is a culture of hardware of its design integrated very nicely with software of its design. We are seeing things like iCloud, where cloud software that isn't specifically integrated into a device, because that's not the way it works, becoming an important part of what they do. I would suggest that that is not the core of their excellence. So, and I think you can see that. I love people who love Apple love to complain about Apple as well. And Apple lovers, Apple users love to complain about what's wrong with the design of their products. And they'll say, well, Apple sacrifices functionality at the altar of design. And you say to those same people, well, are you going to use a different product? Oh, of course not. No. We're going to continue to use Apple products. One of the things that people in the nitty who get into the weeds on this thing complain about is that they don't think that iTunes or iCloud are nearly as excellent or work nearly as well as the software on Apple devices work. And, you know, I think that's a good point.
Do you think Apple will do more? They clearly prefer the app model versus the web model for software. But do you think that, maybe I can just give an example, but, you know, to get software onto your iPhone. You download it from their app store. There's also a web browser where you can access lots of different things. But do you see Apple sort of embracing the web more or sticking to the app approach?
So I have one, the short answer is I do not see them embracing the web. The web is culturally antithetical to Apple, but they don't ignore the web. And one thing that I've noticed that I find amusing, so my book has done very well on Apple's iBookstore, which is their electronic bookstore where you can buy a book for your iPad. And what's interesting is there's a website. They have web pages associated with books that are for sale on the iBookstore. But you go to this website, and it takes you. It'll give you information on the web, and so I can send you a link for purchase information about my book. But in order to buy it, then you click on a link which takes you into iTunes, which of course opens up a piece of client software either on your PC or on your device. And you know, I think that's a decent example of Apple's mentality.
A lot of developers wouldn't find that. They'd be annoyed by that. A lot of developers proponents of, you know, the Google vision of the world. It's all running in the browser, and Apple probably thinks it can have its cake and eat it too, and do a little both.
So having your cake and eating it too is an interesting observation about Apple. So look, they've placed their bet on the application world and on their app store and on their ability to control the environment in their app store, and they're very good about their religion and when they place their bets, right up to the moment that they change their mind about that religion. And the best example of that is that the iPhone did not debut with an app store. And that isn't because Apple decided that it might be a good idea to introduce the app store later. It did it because they didn't do an app store when they launched the iPhone, and software developers immediately began hacking into the iPhone to put their applications on their iPhones. And, you know, again, Apple is stubborn or obstinate or, you know, but not stupid. And I mean that profoundly, because you could see, because they're so focused, you could see them ignoring things that they don't want to know about. But they got the message pretty quickly, and they said, all right, if people are going to hack into the phone, we better turn this into a money-making opportunity and help them. And they did. And, you know, and then again, astoundingly, they got 3 years ahead of the competition on this, on something that they didn't think to do.
That's a good way of putting it. So someone mentioned, besides Tesla, are there any younger or startup companies that you see sort of elements of Apple in?
There's a whole bunch right now. There's a lot of young Apple people who spent, say, 5, 6, 7 years at Apple who are doing startups right now. And some of them have been vocal in their admiration of Apple. And so I'll take two. One is a company started by someone who hasn't worked at Apple but clearly worships at the altar of Apple, and that's Square, whose founder, Jack Dorsey, clearly is behaving in a very Jobs-like way, including, you know, wearing black T-shirts, and not mock turtlenecks, but T-shirts. And, you know, he has two jobs the way Jobs did for a long time. He's full-time at Twitter and full-time at Square. He's stressing, you know, simplicity of design, both in the hardware that Square uses and in the service that they offer. And so there's one example of some similarities. And then the one I talk about in the book that I think is interesting is there's one company I can find in the Valley, a startup that's run by a former senior executive at Apple, and that's Nest Labs, run by Tony Fadell, who was the senior iPod hardware executive at Apple for quite a few years. And by the way, like everyone else, he took a period of time off before doing this. Everyone takes a period of time off.
I also think that's in part because Apple requires them to.
Well, he was paid to take some time off. That's right. He was paid.
That was
well.
The other version of saying.
They disclosed that. Yeah, right. And Apple's famous for the NDAs that it asks people to sign when they leave. You know, you will never talk about anything that happened here ever. Probably not enforceable, but I'm not a lawyer. You know. But what is fun and interesting about Nest is it's sort of obvious. Homage to some of Apple's way of doing things. So they've come out with a learning thermostat that is this beautiful round device that looks like it could easily be sold at an Apple retail store. And it's different. It's not competing directly with anything Apple's remotely doing. And my favorite anecdote about the Nest learning thermostat that Fidel explained to me is that I asked him, so what are you doing that's like Apple? Well, Nest ships with the product a custom-built screwdriver that they believe is the perfect size for do-it-yourself installers to install the thermostat. And obviously everybody who buys a thermostat has a screwdriver in their home. But his attitude was, we want to give them the screwdriver that we think is the right screwdriver to make the installation process as good as possible, because this is an obvious instance where we could screw up with the customer. So let's make it easy for them. It's a beautiful screwdriver, by the way.
Does it fit within the thermostat too, remember?
No, I don't think so, but it's got several heads on it. They're magnetic. It's really neat. You know, it's free. Someone I admire said, I'd buy this screwdriver. I'd buy the thermostat to get the screwdriver. And here's the interesting thing for a startup in its admiration of Apple. Fidel explained to me that his operations people were on him about this screwdriver because it hurts Nest's margins. And his response is, I understand. I don't care. We're a new company. We've got to delight customers, especially when we're a new company. By the way, I asked him, how are you doing things differently from Apple? And he said, well, it's more our relationship with our primary retailer, which is Best Buy, is more like Apple's was when we came out with the iPod in I think it was 2001, 2002. And I can't remember what euphemism he used, but he said, there's more of a cordial give and take and back and forth between us and the retailer because, you know, we have to be a little bit humble. We're just a startup.
Very interesting. What's that? Does Apple have an Achilles heel?
I think it's tempting to say that its arrogance is its Achilles heel. And I say, and I'm not going whole hog on that because I've already told you I think that it is paranoid at the same time. There will be, I can never pronounce the German word, is it Schadenfreude, is that correct? There will be a tremendous amount of that if they screw up. There are all sorts of bitter entities in the world, people and companies who will cheer if they were to fail significantly at something, and there's all sorts of people who would be anguished if they failed. This is a beloved company in addition to being a, I don't want to say hated, but it's probably not unfair to say in certain circles a hated company as well. So I think that's an Achilles heel, potentially.
Were there any misperceptions about Apple that you sort of got a new perspective on in writing the book?
Yeah. There's one, which is, and this is one of these dichotomous ones, I guess, or paradox, and that is this notion that Steve Jobs did everything at Apple. And the problem with it is that it's not a simple subject to explain, because on the one hand, he did have his hands in everything at Apple. He was involved in every major decision, and he did do certain things intimately. You know, he reviewed the advertising copy. He really was the head of marketing for Apple. Call it vice president of marketing, whatever you want to call it, he was. But he didn't oversee building the factories, and he didn't do the initial design on any product. And you know, he didn't site select retail stores. And if you were to inject Apple people with truth serum and you were to go down the list of tasks, and by the way, he had mixed emotions about this, because on the one hand, he felt that Apple was full of fantastic people who did great work. And on the other hand, I think he loved taking credit for Apple's great success, and he deserved a lot of it. So anyway, long-winded way of saying, I think by studying the company carefully, I gained an understanding of the contribution that other people, that non-Steve Jobs people make at Apple, these human beings I've been referring to.
In the book, you actually talk a lot about, I think, Steve's complex relationship with those other human beings in the sense of not letting them join boards for the most part, but also believing in wanting to perpetuate the culture and training that the next generation. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So a few things. You know, he did not want to know, he did not want Apple people to be engaging in outside activities, activities outside of Apple. I mean, going to church and playing tennis were fine if you had time. But he didn't want senior executives serving on boards of directors of other companies. He didn't like the idea of any employees having their names show up on the boards of nonprofits, for example. It would be advocating something and suggesting that Apple was somehow involved, even if the name wasn't there, and also that their time was going to be challenged. Very important to note that Tim Cook, for many years, was the sole exception to this rule, because he's been on the board of Nike for several years. And that was, you know, I can't prove this, but I believe that was clearly a way of Jobs rewarding him, number one, for his, you know, his service, and number two, broadening his horizons. Think about how different Tim Cook is from Steve Jobs. He's a completely different person. And so if I can engage in a bit of psychobabble for a moment, I think it would have been very difficult for Jobs to have tolerated being succeeded by someone like him. And I think it softened the blow to promote and be succeeded by somebody who was so different from him in every single way. And yeah, I think,
and you think that's one of the reasons why their relationship worked so well.
Yes.
When Tim was COO,
yes,
too, right?
There's no doubt. I think they did not get in each other's way. It's not to say, I'm sure Steve Jobs yelled at Tim Cook. I try very hard, by the way, not to ever to talk about Steve, because that's what Apple people do. And this guy was not a friend of mine. And so I try not to suggest that he was Steve.
In the book, you talk about the subject lines of emails that
Steve
were
requests.
Steve requests.
Yeah, this is part of the lore of Apple. But employees at all levels, many levels, would get an email that and the subject line would say Steve request. You didn't need to be a rocket scientist to understand this meant that Steve wanted something. And now, if you were going to send a Steve request, you better be sure that Steve really was requesting that. And there's, you know, whether apocryphal or not, there are stories of people taking liberties with Steve requests. But I ran the following by somebody in a position to know. I believe that there was this piece of Steve Jobs' brain that would have been delighted had Apple collapsed the day that he was no longer there, because this was a man with an ego. But I say the piece of just a piece of his brain, because the rest of him loved this company, you know, arguably more than other aspects of his life. He said publicly many times he loved the company, and so he did want the company to succeed, and that's why I think he genuinely cared about recruiting good people and training them.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question, which I've been saving from the audience. Tell us an interesting anecdote about Apple that didn't make the book. The juicier, the better.
Is this your question or someone from
the
audience?
No, it isn't. Someone has a lovely red pen.
You're going to have to ask me one more, because I put every last juicy bit that I possibly could gather into the book. I did, Jessica.
Is there anything you'd like to change about the book? Add, amend, footnote.
An author always wants to do more. And I could, every subject in the book, I think you could go deeper on. And I think, so I'll give you an example. I intensely would like to see business schools across the land debate this book. I would like them to say to their students, let's read this book and discuss what we've been talking about before we started learning more about Apple's business practices and debate this. And, I would like to know more about the conversation inside the academic world of business and its relationship with Apple, which, by the way, and I discuss this in the book, Apple frustrated the academic community every bit as much as it frustrates the journalistic community. Every company is flattered to no end when the Harvard Business School wants to come in and do a case study for the Harvard Business Review. Not Apple. They say, no, thank you very much. Do your own thing on your own time. We don't have time to meet with you.
And you also talk about in the book how, despite that relationship, Apple hired the dean of Yale Business School to run its internal training program to try to, you know, help train internally managers there.
And at least one former member of the faculty of Harvard Business School to do this. So again, Apple does what's best for Apple. Participating in a Harvard Business Review article might be best for the readers of the Harvard Business Review and for the career of the writer at Harvard Business Review. But bringing some of those fine minds on staff could be very good for Apple, and that is not antithetical to Apple's way of thinking.
Okay. Our thanks to Adam Leshinsky, author of the latest bestseller, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. We also would like to thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the internet. If everyone wouldn't mind staying seated to allow Adam to get to the library, that would be great.
It's like on the airplane when someone's got a flight to catch.
Exactly. I'm Jessica Vassalero, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
You were great. Thank you. Thank you.